Marjorie Hammond Brown. Virginia Harding McGrath will also add her stories. In the old days, it was called the Village. Roughly from east side of Mill Pond Lane, easterly down Main Street, around the corner to the light, and around Bridge Street to Stage Harbor Road. Marjorie is to tell of the houses and people from Mill Pond Lane to School Street on Main Street.
This is Marjorie Brown speaking, and asking you to take a stroll with me down Memories Lane. Let us start with Willie Nickerson's house at the corner of Mill Pond Lane and Main Street, and proceed east. As I remember that house, with Mr. and Mrs. William Nickerson living there, it looked much as it does today, except the west end housed the Western Union Telegraph Office, and Mr. Nickerson could often be seen in the tower with his spyglasses. At that time, many, many boats passed daily. Later, Mrs. Marjorie Haven opened the Hollyhock Inn Tea Room, and also rented a few rooms and one apartment, which was occupied by Mr. and Mrs. Carmi Shattuck. They moved with her to the present Wayside Inn when she purchased it in the fall of 1937. I happened to board there that fall and winter and moved along with the others. The next house was also a Nickerson's. Captain Ziba Nickerson and his wife Eunice Elmina lived there. The third house was occupied by a woman, Emmy Eldridge, who rented a room to Isaac Cohen, who came to town periodically with a pack of sewing materials, salves, and so forth, and walked from door to door selling his wares. My mother usually purchased something to help him out, although I wouldn't be surprised if his bank account was far larger than ours. Later, Virginia Harding lived there with her parents, Judge and Edith Harding. She will tell you more about this house later. Also other earlier Chatham history along this route. Frank Nickerson's house was occupied by himself, his wife, and three children, Beatrice, Francis, and Ziba. This house is presently lived in by the Tom Robinsons. Next came the present Toby home. It was then used in the summer by the Sawyers and was closed in the winter. The Sawyers ran a photography gift shop on Chatham Bars Inn Avenue for several summers in the 1920s and possibly 1930s. The next house I remember best is the home of the Parishes. He, William Dean Parish, was a fine artist, specializing in watercolors and etchings, with an occasional oil portrait for good measure. His wife, Mrs. Annie Parish, taught first grade and was a very popular teacher, both in the local school and in the ME Sunday School. Upon their decease, the house was sold and has been made into apartments. The Green Electronics Shop was previously Nelson Court's Plumber Shop, but I remember it as a grocery store when I was a child. It was run by Eugene Burse, whose family lived in the parish house, and many a time my mother sent me there before closing time at 6 to get something special for our supper. Then in the next house, purchased by Dr. Hopkins, lived a woman by the name of Mrs. Luella Gallagher and her daughter Sadie. This house has been more recently purchased, of course, for the Lulinkos. Now we have come to Homestead Lane. The next house belonged to my cousin, Walter Harding, who lived there with his wife, May. She was a Peters, and that's how the present family of Peters happened to live there. The Eldridge Garage and Taxi Service in Tidehall Filling Station had been a livery stable. After the days of horses and with the advent of cars, Mr. Joseph C. Eldridge went along with the times, and it became what it is today. It was taken over by Mr. Thomas K. Eldridge when his father retired. I understand Virginia McGrath is to tell you about the Monmoy Inn, which her grandfather, John Farmer, ran for many years. So I will skip along to Mr. Hunter's home. He, with his wife, daughter Maud, and her two children, Alta and Hunter Foster, and always a hound dog, lived there pleasantly. Finally, Maud was there alone, and when she became Mrs. John Caton, he joined her and is the present owner. He made extensive repairs, and the house looks like a modern one, although it is actually an old one underneath. The present upholstery shop, run by Mr. Silver, was the home of Frank Rogers, his wife Maddie, and daughter Annie, who was one of the first telephone operators in town, and who held that position until her marriage to a Coast Guard fellow. Her brother Harold also lived there until manhood. The house, now occupied by Edna and Grace Hardy, was their girlhood home, where they lived with their brother Josiah and parents. Their father was a painter and paper hanger, and Edna was local librarian for many years. The Loveland house came next. It housed Mr. and Mrs. Loveland, their sons Clinton and Benjamin, and daughter Ella, who lived there by herself many years. It is presently lived in by Mrs. Mildred Hogg. My own home was owned by my father and mother, Mr. and Mrs. Isaac L. Hammond. When they passed on, it became mine. As Marjorie Hammond, I lived there alone for 13 and a half years before I became Mrs. Charles Brown, and my husband joined me there. I was told by Erastus Bruce that it's the seventh oldest house in town. I never proved the statement, but felt he was one to know. Before it was located on Main Street, it was in a group of houses off Chatham Light, which had to be moved when the ocean took over that area, and the Atlantic Ocean is now where it once stood. The house next door has changed hands more frequently than any of which I know. Once it had four owners in 1 year. When I was a child, Mr. and Mrs. Frank Brown lived there and had a cobbler's shop on the corner, where now is a rose garden. Now let us cross the street and go up westward. The house owned by Freeman Howes was built by Mr. and Mrs. Zenas Howes during my childhood. The large house owned by the Davisons of Ohio is used by them some summers, and it belonged to Dr. and Mrs. Allen Stewart when I was young, and was much more of a show place than it is now. The Moorings, now a motel, was the home of Rear Admiral Rockwell and his three daughters, one of whom was a Mrs. Allen Stewart just mentioned. To the west of that, where Mrs. Martin Brown lives, is the house occupied by Mr. Brown and his first wife and son Harold Brown at the time of which I speak. House number 22 of my story is presently vacant, but Dr. Vincent, a dentist, and his wife Grace lived there. As a widow of many years, Grace rented rooms to summer visitors and was the daughter of the Browns who lived next door to me, and a sister of Mr. Martin Brown, whose property adjoins. The motel, the Dolphin, was a private home owned by people named Bevins. Their daughter Anne was in my second grade class many years ago. Joseph C. Eldridge's home was across the street from his livery stable, and next is a home whose occupants I do not remember at all. But Grace Hardy tells me it was owned by Albert Hammond, father of Captain Walter Hammond and Angie Bruce. The home of Mr. and Mrs. Albert Snow was between that house and Mrs. Mariah Edwards, where she lived with her two daughters, Mariah and Lucy. Hunter Foster has joined the two houses and is now a store. The house and store next has recently been sold. It has been both a paint shop and a butcher shop. Bob Long had a paint shop, but earlier it was Walden Harden's meat market. The old house at the top of the hill belonged to the Heyer family, whose grandson Joseph was in my mother's high school class. As that was in the 1870s, you can see I'm speaking of a long time ago. And now we've come to the local post office, where I first went for my mail. Why not go in, see if Uncle Sam has left anything for you, and find out the gossip from the local people.
Now Virginia may add her information of the earlier houses.
I will add a few bits and pieces of information, some that I have known from actual experience and some that were told to me. Let's start with the William L. Nigerson house on the corner of Mill Pond Lane and Main Street. As Marjorie has said, he was marine reporter for the Boston Globe. I used to spend many hours with Mr. Nigerson. Oftentimes, we would trudge up two flights of stairs, him shadowed by a small chatterbox, cross the attic and up another flight into the cupola, and after noting any passing vessels, he would adjust the spyglass for me to look, but I did better with binoculars because I was nearsighted. He was also a telegrapher, and the office was in the L on Mill Pond Lane. He had a key in the dining room on a small desk. I was absolutely fascinated by it. To think that words could come out of that little thing that went tick, 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 tick. I only wish that I could have been old enough to have learned telegraphy, but I was too small. Also here, I used to see Grandpa Crowell, Mrs. Nickerson's father, when he was sitting out on the porch, and he would always say hello when I went by. Dr. Henry Hopkins had his first office in this building. Next, in Captain Ziba Nickerson's house, live Captain Ziba and Almina. Captain Ziba took my uncle, Captain John Ponfarmer III, as second mate with him on the Bark 7 in 1902. He promised Grandmother Farmer he'd make Uncle John sick of the sea, but he never could succeed. One of the stories that I remember was that Uncle Ziba and Aunt Mina gave a whist party. Aunt Mina vowed there'd be nothing alcoholic in the punch, but Uncle Ziba outfoxed her, and while she was changing her clothes, he really spiked it. After the refreshments had been served and had a chance to get to work, whist playing went to pot. The men were far too busy getting up and kissing all the women. Everybody was very happy except Aunt Mina, who couldn't understand what had happened, for she vowed she'd put no liquor in it. During World War I, Edward and Margaret McCain lived there. Lieutenant McCain was in the Naval Air Station, and when he used to fly the dirigible overhead, Margaret would come out and come up into our yard, and she and Mother would run out in the backyard with dish towels or anything that they could get their hands on and wave to the boys as they flew over. Also here lived Mr. and Mrs. Gubian. He was the manager of the Ginter store, which was the predecessor of the First National stores and was located where the Puritan clothing store is now. Next came my old home, where I lived from 1914 to 1950. Captain Isaiah Lewis had it at one time. It was a Cape Cod house. His daughter Addie Lewis boosted the old house up for a second story and built a new first story. At some time, she had a private school in the big room across the back of the house that later was made into our living room, kitchen, stairs, past pantry, and chimney. Also, it was a boarding house called the Prospect House. In 1880, when Mother was five, Grandfather Farmer rented the house for the summer. He was then the steward of Memorial Hall, the dining hall at Harvard, so that he could take the summer off. In 1913, my father, Heman A. Harding, bought the place, remodeled it, carrying off the old Cape Cod house, which was a second story. We moved in March 1914 and lived there until we moved into the new house on Mill Pond Lane in January of 1950. This was the first house in town to be electrically lighted by a public utility. Father, an attorney, former representative, senator, and harbor and land commissioner, had many political friends, and my mother was an ardent clubwoman and had been third vice president of the Massachusetts State Federation of Women's Clubs. Had many friends amongst the club women. Between them, they had a wide acquaintance. The house has seen many, many prominent people. Mr. Justice Brandeis, Mr. Justice Frankfurter, both of the U.S. Supreme Court, lieutenant governors, attorneys general, other high state officials, members of the legal profession. Admiral Donald McMillan has been entertained there. Sinclair Lewis. Mary Boyle O'Reilly, World War I correspondent, lecturer, and daughter of John Boyle O'Reilly, Irish patriot and poet. A president of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, several presidents of the Massachusetts State Federation of Women's Clubs, and other well-known club women. During World War I, Father was on the Legal Advisory Board, and the place was filled at times with draftees to have their questionnaires made out. Father was the only one that was here on the Cape. Charles Payne was in Washington. Judge Fitz Randolph was over on the Vineyard. And so that Father got the full lot of the questionnaires and draftees. He had them at the Barnstable office, and when he came home, they met him at home. In fact, they were all over the house, and some nights Mother and I had to go to bed because there was no place for us. And finally, Father had to hire desk space at the Mayflower shop so we could have some peace. This house is also known much Red Cross work. Mother and I, as members of the executive board of the Cape chapter, during the Depression time, we gave out clothing. During the early World War II, we gave out knitting and sewing. We've had board meetings galore there. The Visiting Nurse Association held monthly board meetings from 1919 to 1950. The Woman's Club board meetings, through Mother's 5 years as president and my 1 year as president. One woman who asked her young son if he would drive her to a board meeting was surprised when they drew up in front of our house. And she said, this wasn't where I intended to go. Well, he said, you said you were going to a board meeting, and aren't all board meetings held at Mrs. Harding's house? Next comes comes Robertson's house, the Bar's View. This was the Customs House at one time, Captain Isaiah Lewis was the deputy collector. The building now is Wendell Rogers' studio gallery and home opposite the Chatham Theater. The mansard-roofed house was the home of my great uncle, Captain Nathaniel Reynolds. Next, the Sawyer's Place was built by my great uncle, Captain Andrew Reynolds. He died and is buried at Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands after rounding Cape Horn on his way home from a whaling voyage. He said that he had been all over the world, and the most beautiful view in the world was from his back door on a moonlight night looking out over the mill pond. This, too, was the home of Captain Adolphus Ryder. The Sawyers who lived there, Mrs. Sawyer was very musical, a beautiful piano player, and the boys were musical. Harold and Emerson particularly played banjo, trumpet, saxophone, and trombone. On moonlight nights, they used to sit out on their back porch and play and sing, and it did sound so good. In the house that we know as Dr. Hopkins, Captain Elisha Small lived. Then came, of course, Joe Eldridge's stable, and then the Monomoy Inn. Captain Elisha Small lived here, and Captain Sylvester K. Small, who started the inn. This was the traveler's home, later the Monomoy Inn, when Grandfather John Pond Farmer bought it in 1898 and renamed it. My uncle, Captain John Pond Farmer, called this home until his marriage in 1909. Down on the corner of Main and School Street lived Captain Frank Brown. Across the street, Zenas Hawes was a Congressional Medal winner for rescue efforts during the wreck of the Grecian. In the Stuart Rockwell House, Dr. Alan Stuart, the U.S. Navy, was a Southern gentleman from Beaufort, South Carolina, who married Mary, daughter of Admiral Rockwell. In the moorings lived Rear Admiral Charles H. Rockwell and Captain Otis H. Rockwell. In Martin Brown's house, Captain David Harding. What is now the Dolphin Motor Court and was the home of Ralph Bevins. It was built by Thomas Hardy, an ancestor of Ralph Bevins, who came here from Virginia. He spoke of it as my manor house. Here also lived the Croyle boys, five sea captains in one family. Benaja, Herbert, Herman, Lorenzo, and Marshal Kleber, who was named for Marshal Kleber of Napoleonic fame. One was captain of the Harvard, another of her sister ship, the Yale. Joseph Eldridge's house. This was the home of Captain Gustavus Ryder. Here also lived Captain Elmer F. Mayo, the hero of Monomoy. After the Monomoy disaster, a fund was raised with which was purchased this house and presented to Captain Mayo, also the vessel Leglina, with which he went anchor dragging, that is, salvaging ship's anchors lost when a cable parted or when there wasn't time to haul in the anchor and the cable had to be cut. I remember him as an old man whom the old folks used to call Buzzy Mao. In Sousa's house, next to that, lived Captain Albert S. Hammond, Captain Walter I. Hammond, and Captain Marcus A. Hammond. Next in the Snow's house was Albert Snow, Civil War veteran. In Long's was Captain Walden Harding and Captain William I. Harding. In the Higher House, this was the home of Captain Thomas Dodge. Miss Mary Emma Dodge, his daughter, was a school teacher, and she lived there. I used to go calling there with Mother and sat on the slipperiest horsehair sofa that ever existed. If you know the kind, you sit down carefully and brace your feet so you stay there. Next came Tom McGrath's, my husband's. It was the old post office. First, it was Quilty's first store. Then it became the McCarran Shepherd plumber shop, then the J.H. Shepherd Company plumber, then Tom McGrath, the printer, my husband. The other building was Chester Eldridge's plumbing shop, which Tom converted into a home. And where the lawn was, Daisy Gill had a little store. On the Colin Gibson lot was the home of Captain Levi Dean Smith. The bake shop, as it is now, was John Collins' fish market. The block, where the block is now, Frank Kelly's variety store stood on the corner, Jack McKay's barbershop, and the post office. This is Virginia again. I want to tell you about my grandfather Harding's store down in the village. Out on the front, it said Andrew Harding's, but he was commonly called Uncle Andrew. Andrew Harding, storekeeper, painter, wrecker, 14th child of Captain Barzilla and Patty Bangs Harding, born 125 years ago on November 20th, 1836. Died November 23rd, 1911, aged 75 years. Father of Heman Andrew Harding and grandfather of Virginia Avis Harding McGrath. It is difficult to separate the store from the man, but while the man shapes the store, in a more subtle way, the store shapes the man. Among his brothers and sisters were Isaiah and Simeon. Dale's History of Barnstable County on page 597 says, Isaiah and Simeon Harding had a store over the shore, which business they sold to Andrew Harding in 1865. Mr. Harding had started a store on Water Street in 1864, but bought and combined the two. In 1871, in connection with his stock of paints and oils, he started his painting business with H.M. Smith, unquote. Father had penciled in the margin beside this paragraph, southwest corner of A.H. Homestead, later ahead of Mill Pond, north of Mary A. Young Boathouse. For a time, I wondered why it was that grandfather started the store on Water Street, and then I realized that his first wife, Aunt Abby, was sick, and that he probably had the store in the house to be near her. She died in January of 1865, and that was probably why he was at liberty to buy out his brothers and combine the two stores. I also wondered why the store was down by the mill pond. Then I realized that probably everything came in by packet, doubtless the New Bedford packet. And because Isaiah was a captain, and because the father Barzilla had been a packet captain, I have an idea that probably Isaiah was captain of the packet that went to New Bedford. This material I have drawn from memories, from father's stories and grandfather's account books. Grandfather's account books cover the entire period from October 5th, 1864 to time of his death, November 23rd, 1911, a period of 47 years. These books show only items charged, not cash sales. Sometime in the 1870s, he tired of keeping his ledger but kept up his day book. How do you know who owed what? Accounts sometimes difficult to decipher because grandfather scrawl in his go-as-you-please spelling. For instance, entry of L-E-A-T-H-R-A-G-E is his version of lithage, a drying constituent of paint. He was Uncle Andrew to everyone and was beloved. He was most accommodating. Grandmother would see him coming home, would take up dinner, put it on the table, and wait. Someone had hailed him, and he'd gone back to sell them what they wanted rather than make them come back. When grandfather died, father sent receipted bills to all those old men and women and those who couldn't afford to pay. And now let's go inside the store, but before we do, let's stop and look at the anxious seat, as grandfather called it, on the porch. Here on this seat, the men waited anxiously for grandfather to come home from dinner, or come back to the store from dinner. Inside, on a warm, sunny day, it was like stepping into a cool, cool, dark place. In the wintertime, there was a stove in the center around which the men sat. Here the men of the village sat around the stove and swapped yarns of their experiences at sea, the wrecks to which they had gone, resailed their voyages to distant ports, and retold the sea stories told them by their fathers and grandfathers. And as they talked, they whittled lobster pegs, thole pins, buoy markers, and all the other impedimenta needed by seamen about their boats. Arguments sometimes arose concerning the location or approaches of various harbors. For that reason, chalk was always kept over the door. Shavings were pushed aside by a booted foot, and a chart of the waterway was chalked on the floor. Arguments further ensued, and with various scrubbings, the chart was drawn and redrawn until finally they were satisfied. Finally, leaving the argument as a dog leaves a well-chewed bone, peace would be restored and they would move on to the next topic. Here too, grandfather cast up the accounts of the village weir company, for which he was agent and part owner. Only he wouldn't have called it weir, but would have given it the old pronunciation, wire. Counters were around the inside of the store. Shelves. How grandfather found anything, I don't know. All right. Grandfather was as kindly and inefficient a businessman as ever lived, who kept his books nonchalantly, his money in a sock in his desk. His banking he did in Harwich at the nearest bank, on those days when he went to Harwich with his horse and wagon to haul his freight from the Harwich railroad station, his pork barrel out on the porch of the store, and his faith in the trustworthiness of his fellow men. Looking over his account books, his store must have been a glorious hodgepodge, a mad scramble, a jumble of paints, hardware, foodstuffs, everything unimaginable except meats, household goods, and women's gear. For the latter, he would have sent you to Phoebe Helen's down the street. Women customers must have felt they were running the gauntlet as they waded through goods, shavings, and men on their way to the counter. How Grandfather located their wants is little short of miraculous, but he did unerringly. One of Father's favorite stories was the story of Uncle Silas and the sweet potato barrel. Grandfather started to close up one noon, and he found that Uncle Silas was still asleep. He'd sat down on the sweet potato barrel, as was his usual custom, and he'd gone to sleep. Grandfather had done him dirt because he'd sold some of the sweet potatoes, and Uncle Silas had slid down into the barrel further than he had expected to. So Grandfather went over and shook him gently and said, "Come, Uncle Silas, it's time for us to go home for dinner." And his father told him that Uncle Silas fetched a heave, and nothing happened. And he fetched another heave, and still nothing happened. And finally, Grandfather said to him, "Well, Uncle Silas, I guess I'll have to cut the hooks, won't I?" "Yes, for God, Andrew, I guess you'll have to cut the hooks." The men had pilot boats that they went wrecking with, and one of them they named the Castor and Pollux, for the Gemini, the stars for which the sailors sail. And someone, not being up in his classical mythology, called it Cast Iron Pollux. It was short of the Pollux. And so when they bought their next boat, they said, "Well, they've got the hat and the Pollock. They might just as well call this one the Haddock." So the next boat was called the Haddock. The men who were around the store were Frank Tinkham, Seth Hammond, Clarendon Robbins, Goodwater Eldridge, and Wickedwater Eldridge, and others that I can't quite remember. Grandfather's first sale was to Mr. Nathaniel Freeman, October 5th, 1864, one paintbrush, 92 cents. 4 gallons of raw oil at $1.50, $6. 50 pounds of New York lead at 15 cents, $7.50, a total of $14.42. His last sale to Captain B.L. Jones, April 24, 1911, one box of cigars net, $2. Some of the things that he sold were paints, varnish, putty, raw and boiled oil, window glass, window locks, lamp black, picture knobs, hardware, fruits, cheese, tobacco, nails, screws, flour, beans, molasses, sugar, doorbells, tea and coffee, hard bread, or as we know it now, powder cracker, crackers, soap, candy, Arabian balsam, painkiller, carriage top dressing, shovels, corn cakes, fire kindlers, which he made himself. He held a patent on this for fire kindlers, which were made of resin and sawdust. Then he also sold boot blacking, spices, pork, sweet potatoes, white potatoes, onions, turnips, net twine, rope, yeast powder, which came in papers, to my surprise, matches, which came in bunches, hatchets, axes, fish hooks and cod line, shot, caps, pipes at 1 cent each, which were the clay TD pipes, lamp chimneys, padlocks, walnuts, saleratus, knives, candy, canned goods, clam barrels, herrings, cigars, patent medicines, oars, and rowlocks, and many, many other things. May has asked me to add that the Croyle boys would signal their mother as they went by turning their searchlights on the house so that she would know they were going by. She's also asked me to add a story that my father used to tell. When he was a young boy, he used to play with Sam Hardy, son of the keeper of the lighthouse, Captain Hardy. And one day, Captain Hardy said to them, "Now, boys, you want to remember this day, the longest day you live. There have been as many ships by here as there are days in the year."
Continued on the other half of the tape.